Hello and welcome to another episode of Conduit Conversations for 2022, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. My guest today is Tom McGillicuddy. Tom has 10 years of investment management experience, starting his career at Barclays before moving to Wellington Management, where he was part of the founding team of their $2 billion Global Impact Fund. He is a CFA charterholder and a co-founder of the investment platform of the future, Circa 5000. Welcome, Tom. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you began your career working at Barclays, and apparently you weren't content. What did you feel was missing, and do you see this as part of your journey to Circa 5000?
Yeah, 100%. I think I started my career at Barclays, and I felt prior to joining that I'd won the lottery in like every sense of the word, in the sense that I had, on the surface, a fulfilling long potential career where I could earn a lot of money. And that was my kind of priority at the start of my career, was get to a career where I could earn a lot of money. But I kind of soon realized that that wasn't interesting to me. Learning a lot about finance, economics, the markets, etc., was fascinating. You learn how the world works, but there was a massive missing gap of purpose. And I started to have this like crisis of mission in about 2011, 2012, and not many other people around me at that time were thinking like that at Barclays. I don't think they are much now, but they definitely weren't then, over 10 years ago. And a good friend of mine, who's a bodybuilder, he went vegan. And I was like, how can you be a vegan bodybuilder? How does that work? And he did it for climate change reasons. And he shared with me all the documentaries and essays that he read to kind of change his mind. And I was like, I'll give that a go for 2 weeks. And then I was vegan for 3 years. And then I kind of became consumed by positive impact and the desire to do something positive in my day-to-day life, not just my dietary choices or my private life. And that kind of started me off thinking, how could I, you know, harness my skills in financial services to have some kind of bigger purpose?
So before we get on to have a conversation about Circa 5000, I want to ask you, why is it that you think that people can't necessarily make change from within traditional investment banks? Mm. Like, why didn't you stage an insurgent campaign and try and reform the institution from within, as opposed to going out and starting your own thing?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm a very impatient person. So I think when you're at those big organizations, even with the best will in the world, and I know there's some people at those companies who are really impact aligned, really mission driven, and have the best intentions, but it just takes forever to get anything done. And the leadership and the hierarchy don't believe in these things. Now, some of that's changing in certain organizations, but by no means the whole industry. And I kind of came up against that over and over again. You know, people, the full spectrum of, that's a nice little idea, but that's not what we're about here, to actively, we don't ever want to do any of those things, because that's the opposite of what we're trying to do here. And so it was through years of, you know, trying to push the envelope, trying to convince people, that I just started to realize that it's never going to happen in a meaningful time frame. If I stay within this industry, I've got to go outside of it and try and change it. It was just glacial, the pace, you know.
So you describe Circa 5000 as the leading investment platform dedicated to creating a livable, prosperous future for humanity. So for the uninitiated, tell us exactly what it is that you do.
Yeah. So I think it's important to kind of add an additional kind of pillar of the business. The first is obviously about impact investing. I'll kind of explain exactly how we approach it. And the second is really accessibility, because Matt, who's the other founder of the business, we met on our first day at Barclays 11 years ago. We actually lived together for the first 8 weeks and became very close friends. And we were the first people in our family to go to university, leave the towns that we're from, and kind of enter a world where we had no idea what it was like. And when we're on the other side, we saw that the investment industry kind of seemed designed to confuse people, to me and to Matt. A lot of complex language, the idea that you need a lot of money to do certain things. And we just felt like it didn't need to be that way. And it could be really simple to get people to start investing. That was like a separate and adjacent conversation to the impact investing conversation that started a little bit later. And so what we wanted to do when we left our jobs, Matt was at Barclays this whole time, I was at Wellington, was bring what we were doing in impact investing for institutional clients. So the clients of the Wellington Fund were pension funds and family offices and wealth managers, institutional clients. Bring the best of that approach, but bring it to a retail audience and at the same time, remove all the barriers to investing as well. So you get people that have predominantly never invested before, who didn't think they could, to invest for the first time and do it with impact as their first kind of foray into the investing industry. And we felt like if you could do that at scale, millions of customers ultimately, you create impact investing as the default option for people because they've never known anything else. And so we felt like impact investing had a unique kind of potential to engage people because of the narrative, the feel-good factor. We knew it was the future of the entire industry. We believed in it. It was in our DNA. So we took that feel-good factor storytelling element of it and put it in front of an audience that had never invested before, and it just captured their imagination. That was the theory of the start of the business. So the basics of what we do is we're an app-first business. We will have a desktop version, but that's a few months away. And the idea is that you come onto the platform, you select an investment theme, people, planet, or people and planet together, a risk level, high, medium, and low, and then you can start investing for yourself, your children, or for your own pension. And in the background, what you have is hundreds of businesses around the world, listed global businesses, listed on the stock market. For now, that's the first kind of investment that we look to make in the background. And all the investments are linked to the theme that you selected through the product and service they sell, so the revenue that they generate. So if you go on Planet, you'll find clean energy companies, and they're 100% exposed to, you know, various forms of clean energy. We've created those themes and those portfolios in the background. All you need to do is go, this theme, that risk level, this account type, and you're in. And, you know, 90% of our customers who sign up, complete sign up in like 2 minutes. Once you're in the product, we send a lot of investment education to our customers because most of them, about 80%, have never invested before. So it's important to know important to kind of get them up to speed on why we've built the app in a certain way, what's going on in financial markets. And we also send a lot of impact measurement, impact reporting, and impact stories about the companies and the impact they're having around the world to them to engage them. So that's the kind of basics of why and what the product is today.
So a lot of what people complain about in the impact world is this idea of greenwashing or a typology that seems very simple and very compelling, but when you dig down is actually much more complex and much murkier. Mm. And you obviously have done something that is just the way you describe it. Its elegance is its simplicity. Mm. You can sign up for 2 minutes, you can choose people, planet, or both, and then you can start having your money channel in to these positive companies with double bottom lines, achieving good in the world, but with good returns.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about just your kind of impact framework and how you think about it, because it's such a core question that people think about in this field.
Yeah, so where possible, we use as much of our own data and third parties' data and use the impact management projects framework for assessing the impact of all the companies and the themes that we invest. So that's kind of the industry standard approach to impact investing in public markets that we use. And amongst all of that, the first major point of sifting, if you like, for us is we're trying to assess with as much clarity as possible the revenue sources of the companies we invest in. And where possible, we only invest in pure play companies. And what we mean by that is 100% of their revenue is from this one activity. It's super clear what the impact of that revenue could be or its intention is. And then we start measuring the other areas. So that kind of, if you think about there's roughly 10,000 businesses in listed markets, that probably gets the universe down to like 600, 700, and then you can move from there, basically. And that is the massive difference between us and the greenwashers /ESG/sustainable is we're trying to take an impact-first approach. The best way of doing that, in our opinion, to start with, is look at what the company does from a product and service it sells, and then you can move on to the other layers and measure, you know, intentionality and the outcomes of that after. And that's the first major sift that helps us get a purity of implementation from the themes. And that's kind of our ideology of how we developed it in our previous jobs.
So if you have a subset, I won't hold you to these numbers, but if you have a subset of 600 companies out of 10,000, whatever, you know, that's your subset of pure play impact companies that you then channel the resources of your users of your platform into. Have you found that the returns are correlated with the market, uncorrelated with the market, better or worse? How do they deal with crises like Ukraine happening right now, is there some, you know, beta in how your set of companies are performing in financial terms because of their impact orientation?
It's a great question. I think if you look at our themes from a purely traditional asset management lens, what you would see is we're slightly more mid to small cap biased, slightly more growth biased, slightly more emerging markets biased, basically, versus just the general stock market. So in certain market conditions, they've done exceptionally well. So the past few years, our portfolios have performed well. This year, so far, the Russia-Ukraine situation, it's been a bit of more of a choppier start to the year, but that's been the same for kind of absolutely anybody, unless it was oil and banks that you were invested in. So what we talk about with our customers is when you come to invest on the platform, it's important to state that we're not a trading platform in the sense that the customers should be investing for 5, 7, 10 years where possible. This is proper kind of long-term market cycle investing. The investment profile in terms of risk return stack up really at scale. In these little moments in markets, there may be periods of massive outperformance and underperformance. But I would say broadly the market, broadly since we've launched, we're outperforming the general stock market. And that's been over 2.5 to 3 years. So that's the general experience of our customers so far.
So you've spoken about, you know, the pure play revenue approach. By that, I take it that you mean you try to understand how the companies get their revenue and you try and understand the impact of the sales that they achieve in order to get that revenue on people and the planet and try and make that as pure as possible.
Yeah.
That seems to me to be unassailably a good thing.
Yeah.
Do you also look at the quality of the management and governance of those companies? Because obviously it's a specific kind of mission-driven person, not unlike yourself, who's choosing to set up a company which is doing that. And there are some, you know, are there some positive correlations with how these places are governed and by whom, apart from their underlying economic performance?
Yeah, 100%. So we're trying to find companies that are being founded from the ground to solve an issue. And that's in their DNA, is kind of mission-locked businesses. It's not companies that just happen to be solving a problem. We're trying to find intentional solutions to these major issues. And then once we've kind of done that revenue sift effectively, we're looking at corporate governance, how they treat their employees, how they treat the local communities in which they operate, what their supply chains are like. And sometimes you get revenue lines that seem perfect and the revenue is great, but then these other factors come into it and they kind of rule them out. So we're trying to find, this is where like a more traditional ESG, I would say, approach may come into it as a second and third layer effectively. Are they also good corporate citizens? Are they well run as a business? Will they kind of stay true to their mission from a kind of shock, or will they ever change what the kind of future path of where the business is going? All these are considerations after that first big initial sift. So yeah, we're trying to find like these, in a way, like a holy grail company. Not every company is perfect. There are some risks and some problems you have to get comfortable with, because if you don't, you would never make an investment. But yeah, we're assessing management and internal structures as much as anything.
So over the years in Conduit Conversations, I've spoken to a range of founders who have built or are building what will become or are already very successful companies. And I'm always interested in not just the kind of glory retrospective, oh my goodness, we were always going to win, aren't we fabulous kind of stories, but I'm also interested in hearing difficulties and challenges, hard times, things where you doubted yourself, things that were complicated, because I think those things are as instructive to our listeners as the kind of stories of unalloyed success. So tell me something.
There's two major things I'll tell you, but I could tell you 200. But I'll give you one example of a period of time, and it was the beginning of COVID, right? So we were a very, very early stage now. We were very, very early stage 2 and a bit years ago. And we were about to go through a round of funding, a VC-led, a venture capital-led round of funding. And we were at the investment committee stage, which is the final yes-no stage, with about 4 funds. And that was the week after lockdown was announced in the UK. So all those investment committee meetings got cancelled because the world was in crisis mode. Not anyone's fault. It's just the way that kind of how it panned out. But all well and good, but we had 3 months of money left in the bank at that point. We had a team of 16 of us. And on my birthday, which is in March, I think this was a few days either before or after the lockdown was fully announced, we had to furlough the whole team, basically. So we went down to 4 of us. There was Tristan, one of our most senior software engineers, Lauren, who's head of customer operations, and myself and Matt, just to keep the organization alive for however long we could, basically. And it didn't look like we were going to do that. We were weeks or days away from going bankrupt, basically. And I'd moved back to my parents to have lockdown in a house with a garden and not be in a one-bedroom flat in East London. And I was doing so many calls each day in the back garden to try and save the business that I wore all the grass out in the back garden. It was gone. And thankfully enough, the government released the Future Fund program, which was if you received a qualifying investment of X amount, the government would effectively double it and take a stake in your business. So some of our existing shareholders got together an amount of money and the government then doubled it, and we managed to save the business. Just that money gave us enough money to bring back some of the team from furlough, start marketing again, because overnight we cut the burn, the monthly cost of the business, by 90%. So we stopped marketing, furloughed the team, the business really went under. We just saved it, and then we kicked back marketing again and started off all over again. But we were a whisker away from going bankrupt because of the time. And I know it's not a video, it's a podcast, but the listeners won't be able to see how many wrinkles I have on my face now. I didn't used to have any of these, you know? And that was mainly because of that period. But it's made us much stronger as a business. The second major area is fundraising. So even if businesses are exceptional, you'll get like 99 no's out of 100 in terms of pitching the business to VCs and angel investors. You have to have an exceptionally thick skin to constantly deal with that. So now I take rejections happily and in my stride, because I know it doesn't mean that we're bad and nobody wants us. It's just not right in that given moment to that investor. So getting used to rejection constantly is part and parcel of starting a business.
So you're tiptoeing into my next question, and that is somebody's trying to set up an impact business and they're listening to these stories, which these stories are, you know, stories of resilience. Mm-hmm. You're about to go under, COVID's about to kill you, mm-hmm. and you survive, you get used to rejection, right? But tell me some kind of positive things. Like if you're sitting down sketching on the back of an envelope a business you're hoping to launch, and it's an entirely different sector, but you're wanting to hear from a founder who's saying, here are some things that you really should do to set yourself up for success, almost like business hygiene or mental hygiene or leadership hygiene. Like, what are the things that you should do to build a successful business in the impact space?
In the impact space. So, one superpower you have over non-impact companies is your ability to recruit people that you don't have a right to recruit in the early days, because you have a mission, you have a DNA, and you have a brand that actually means something. And it is not like, you know, a mission fitted after you've started the business to make it sound kind of positive. So I would use that very early on to get yourself a strong initial kind of team. My one piece of advice I always give people is and this is impact or non-impact, but I think it, you know, matters, you know, twice as much in the impact sector, is have a co-founder who you trust with your life, basically. Because Matt and I have a benefit of knowing each other for 11 years, but we couldn't have done it without each other. Not because we have complementary skill sets, but because there's just so much you've got to do and there's so much pressure to kind of have on your shoulders that it helps to share the burden, basically. So I speak with people who are solo founders quite a bit and they come to me for advice, and that is my advice, my number one piece of advice, because you'll get so much more done. You have someone to speak to about the problems that you're facing, and it can be a lonely experience because there's not that many other people that are going through what you're going through. So just to have somebody by your side that you really trust is so important. So that's number one thing. And the number two thing is probably not as fashionable as any of those things, but it's like some old school good business sense. Like, have a potentially profitable business. Have something that you sell where the sale price covers more than the costs to create the product or whatever that you sell. Because the holy grail is to not have to take any outside funding in. I know that's, you know, we've done that. We've raised, you know, over £10 million of outside funding. But it puts you in such a powerful position where you don't have to. And you don't have to constantly prove the unit economics. And you don't have to go, yes, this works, but only when we've got 10 million customers. Make it work at a smaller scale, then scale that. So those piece of advice that they come to my mind straight away.
So I suspect that you're not going to be content with, you know, just rolling out circa 5,000 in its current form, and that you have future plans and wanting to evolve and take the platform and do deeper and better things. So if I'm right, tell me what those are.
Yeah, I think, you know, you've hit the nail on the head. You know, we are an impact business. In order for us to have any meaningful impact, we need to be of a massive scale because we're trying to change the way an industry operates. You can't do that even with a billion of AUM in our industry. It needs to be much, much bigger. So on one side, it's European expansion from, you know, later this year / early 2023, and then as quickly as we can to go to the US as well, because that's the, you know, the biggest single market. We're also launching our own circa 5,000 branded funds, our own ETFs that are built from scratch by us using our methodology, then created into ETFs to be distributed around the world. The idea is that we become the place to impact invest from a retail perspective globally. And our funds that power our core app sit around the world and are the impact layer that powers the retail impact investment world. And as we scale the business, we go down the spectrum of impact with the investments that we offer. So now we're doing predominantly listed equities. We can start to do private and VC in early stage and then go down the spectrum so that our customers can have whatever level of impact they want, whatever level of liquidity they want from their impact investments. And we cover the entire spectrum. That's the kind of vision of the business.
And for those people who are not finance geeks, what is an ETF and how does it work?
Yeah. Sorry, I've jargoned. I don't even know I'm doing it sometimes. An exchange traded fund, which is basically a liquid listed basket of stocks, effectively, that are all grouped together because of some commonality. So, for example, you could have an ETF that is, say, the top 50 sustainable food and agriculture companies in the world as kind of agreed by our methodology. And we kind of want to roll those out across, as we see it, the five key areas of impact in listed markets. And they're kind of our blueprint for how we look at the impact investment world. They'll be coming out from September this year. So it's a huge step for the business to get those out in the market.
Super exciting. Well, Tom, thank you very, very much for your time. I encourage everybody to go and look at Circa 5000 and see what they do and make your own investment decisions accordingly. But a really, really interesting company trying to blend together finance and impact with a really passionate co-founder who we're very, very happy to have as part of the Conduit community as well. So thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations. Please do subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. To learn more about Tom and the work of Circa 5000, please visit their website. And for more information about the Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com.